Dun, dun, dun. That's right, folks. Get your space helmets ready and prepare for a journey beyond the stars because we're diving headfirst into the mind-bending world of 2001, A Space Odyssey, this month for Silver Screen Cinema Classics. Buckle up because Stanley Kubrick's cinematic masterpiece is about to take you on a trip so trippy you'll be questioning reality faster than you can say, "Open the pod bay doors, Hal." From monoliths to malfunctioning AI, this film has it all, except maybe in straightforward plotline. So grab your freeze-dried snacks because we're about to explore the final frontier of cinema and try to figure out if there's more to life than just floating around in a really stylish spacesuit and the universal truth of dealing with IT problems. So welcome. This is only our third Cinema Classics, so if you're new to us, we'll be going through everything as we sort of hit the sections and things. But don't worry, we will get to the main bulk of the review, and I'll leave to sort of time codes and things if that you just want to skip straight to that. But beforehand, I have to introduce myself, first of all. So I am the mission commander for this particular endeavor, Mike Wilson, the usual host of Cinema Classics. And I'm not here on my own. On this virtual Discovery One, I am joined by two guests straight out of cryosleep. So first of all, on special assignment from the Comfortable Spot podcast, please welcome, you may have heard him on our sister podcast, Hit or Miss Star Trek, it's Ken Sweeney. Welcome.
Hi, how are you? Really great to be here. Yeah. Can't wait to talk about this modern classic, I think we'll call it, you know. So it's brilliant.
Yeah, well, it's not that modern, 1968.
It's modern when you're over 50. So,
shush, don't let people know how old we are. And we're also joined by something of a regular kind of right hand of mine. You'll have heard it all over the Silver Screen podcast in various places. So welcome back, Sandra Evanson.
Hello. Good to be back. It's been a while since I've really seen y'all.
It has, but I'm glad to have you back for this one and to have you be one of the first guests to Chris in the Cinema Classics. Because this is a whole new thing, and because I'm ripping off the idea wholeheartedly from DK over on the cult classics that he does, I want to start off with a little bit of getting to know you guys' taste in classic cinema. So before we jump into 2001, I wanted to ask, what is your favourite cinema classic, by which I mean anything basically more or less from the birth of cinema till no later than 1979? And Ken, I'm going to come to you first because you're the first-time guest for the Silver Screen.
I mean, I'm not a great fan of classic cinema, to be honest. I mean, I will sit down and watch a movie that I may have seen before, and not necessarily science fiction, because I actually think science fiction, up to, say, as you said there, the beginning of the 80s, what it lacked in the ability for special effects, it kind of created and replaced that with a really good usual plot line. So I think if I was to come up with, you know, classic movies as maybe as a young guy and maybe as a teenager who revisited them, say when Deep VHS was out, I liked Planet of the Apes, the first one. I thought it was absolutely,
we're doing that excellent. Actually in a few months time over on Cinema Classics.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was a brilliant film, really, really good. And I would have enjoyed a lot of the actual war films at the time that were out from, say, the 1960s, during the 1960s. And for me, War Eagle's Dare was an amazing movie. But again, okay. I take these movies because I look at the development in them and how really well produced and well directed and well written they were. I particularly like War Eagle's Dare, not because it's just not because it's a war film, because it's actually anything but really a war film. When you read the book and when you look at that, the principal concepts in it are that everyone has a part to play, and it's not always the big, strong, macho guys that are critical, because there are two fantastic actresses in that film who really, really stand their ground in terms of keeping up with ultimately huge egos of Clint Eastwood and Richard Burton. So that's a great film for me. I mean, I'm just moving into the 70s then, I would have been a huge fan of the China Syndrome, which was a fantastic movie. I think it's gone under the radar a lot. It was made around 1976. It starred Jack Lemmon and a very young Douglas, what's his name? Michael Douglas and Jane Fonda. Yeah. And it was made in those, you know, in the way that these brilliant drama movies were made, in that they had a really, really good story and, you know, didn't give a hoot about any kind of special effects. It was all down to the actors. It was all down to the script.
Yeah.
And it's about basically a near miss in a nuclear power station while a TV crew is there and there's a cover-up attempted. It's it's an incredible film. I'd actually go back. I would actually recommend anybody to go back and watch that because it's such a really good film and it's iconic of those fantastic movies, which I could keep going till Christmas, that were made really at the golden age of cinema, I think.
Yes, Andy, over to you with the big question then. Do you have a particular cinema classic within those kind of boundaries that I set for you there?
For me, again, not a huge fan of, you know, cinema that old, but I'm a huge fan of cinematography. It's probably one of the biggest things I look for in films. So it is easy for me to, I think, pick a favorite. It's probably Psycho, the original Psycho, because I just really like that a lot. And it's hard for me to connect to a lot of older films. Having seen this again after having not seen it in so long, I really feel this movie, 2001, displaces Psycho, which would have been my obvious answer before. I love this one. Mm-hmm. I think a modern classic, I believe that because it's something that every generation can rediscover for itself. And it hasn't aged, in my opinion. It's so spectacular.
Yeah. So, yeah, if you are, like I said, new here, what we do, I keep my notes kind of vaguely organized into things like acting, directing, special effects, music and sound, various categories like that. But, you know, it's quite a free-flowing conversation at the same time. That's just for the purposes of keeping my brain organized. So that's how we're going to do that when we get to it. But I do like to get a little bit of background when it comes to these films, first of all, particularly with something like a classic that people might not have seen. So again, sorry to put you guys on the spot here, and I'll go to Ken first to give you a chance to think about this, Sandy. But I'm always curious, what was your first time watching this film, and what was your initial opinion of it, and what did you come away thinking? And Ken, yeah, I'm going to come to you and ask you that first.
That's very easy for me to talk about. My dad passed away in 1985, and he was like a bit of a, you know, he would have been a geek, you know, and if you were to attach a modern kind of tag to him. But before he passed away, we used to have here in Ireland where I am, they'd have premieres, you know, so they'd have the, you know, the Irish TV premiere of, you know, the Gone with the Wind. Mm. And so what they did then was they had an Irish TV premiere of 2001. Because that movie actually was restricted from being on television for quite a long time. I mean, it was over almost 15 years before it eventually made it onto terrestrial television. And, you know, we have to kind of take into account that this was long before Sky Movies or anything like that, or even, you know, and even VHS would have been in its very, very infancy in terms of it being a commercial success in the household. So, it was basically a premiere on the television. I remember actually, you know, I'd gone to bed a little bit earlier. And, you know, my dad woke me up. He said, come on, it's starting now. And it was starting at 9:30 after the, you know, the Saturday evening news. And I sat down and he said to me, look, it's just that what you were talking about there about the plot. My dad said, look, just don't worry about the plot. Don't ask me any questions. Just enjoy the spectacle. And then when we'll watch it again sometime and then I'll talk to you more about the plot. And he says, I'll get you the book. And then unfortunately, he passed away the following year. So we never got to watch it again. But it's a very memorable thing for me because it's one of the few films that I actually remember watching with my dad. And, you know, it's just like, you know, because prior to that, he would have sat down and watched maybe the Marx Brothers with me or, you know, those kind of 40s and 50s horror movies with Bela Lugosi and all that kind of thing, or The Outer Limits. My father had a big, big thing for The Outer Limits. He was never a Twilight Zone fan, but he loved The Outer Limits. And of course, he loved Star Trek and he had an appreciation for Star Wars as well. But for him, 2001 was the kind of, you know, the benchmark movie. He was a very big fan of Kubrick, as I found out later on from my mum. So, yeah. So, you know, that was very easy for me to remember. And like I say, just to sum it up, I didn't really understand the plot, but actually I was keen to understand the plot. So I did go to the library and after my dad passed away and I bought all of the books at that time up to, say, 2010. And then 61 came out a few years later and then 3001 came out in the mid 90s. So, yeah. And I became a huge Arthur C. Clarke fan as a result of it. So, yeah, very easy for me to remember. So I hope that answers the fight.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it sounds like me and your dad would have got along. And I'm sorry about your loss, but I do love hearing these stories about family members, particularly if you know, it's a pleasant memory of family members that have sat you down. Mm. And I won't sort of name the particular person, but I have a friend of mine who was very close to his uncle who passed away, but all of his sort of nicest memories of his uncle were when he used to sit him down and show him videotapes that he got from Blockbusters, and it was like a little film education that he gave mm-hmm. him. And I absolutely love hearing that. I don't have any children myself, but if I did, or if I ever sit and, you know, babysit or look after any of my younger relatives, I'm going to be doing that, or I often always do that and say, you know, this is, you'd have to sit and watch this one now. You've got to give this classic a go. But, so that's really cool. Awesome. So what about you, Sandy? Can you remember the first time you saw it and your thoughts?
I can. I found Ken's to be a very moving experience. That's pretty awesome. Yeah. Mine a little later in life when I was in my 20s, and it's kind of when movies first to me became less of just something I either liked the movie or I didn't like the movie, and I started to more explore different things about the movies, like kind of more as an art. And that's when I first sat down to watch it by myself in my room. I think I had rented it from Blockbuster. And I remember just really being jarred by the physical. I was actually frightened when watching the movie. I remember feeling scared, and I was talking to Mike how I was shocked that it was rated G, actually. It was really shocking to me, but we'll talk about that. I read a little bit more into it. But that was really my first experience seeing it. I just really watched it because I liked The Shining, and I thought, well, you know, let's see, what is a style? What is a director's style? You know, I was still kind of learning about that. So then I watched that, and some visuals obviously pop up when you think about it immediately. I couldn't remember any of those things in context. So seeing this again last night was really awesome.
Yeah, for sure. And it's actually brought something to my mind there, which is that I would have said, if you kind of are new to film criticism or you find it all a bit too much, Stanley Kubrick, whatever you might think of him personally, which we'll leave out of this, is actually a fantastic person to study if you're wondering about an auteur, is what they call it, a director who has their own very personal kind of style and their own stamp that you can kind of sense through all their movies. And I think, yeah, like you, my personal favorites are 2001 and The Shining. And you might think there's nothing, you know, that would link those two. But I think if you were to do a comparison, there's actually quite a lot, you know, in terms of shot composition and the way things are done and pacing, you know, the long shots, various bits and pieces that we don't need to get into because it would get far too technical and people would switch off. But yeah, and I mean, I don't necessarily love the others as much, but with his entire filmography, you could look at and you could identify kind of the key things in, you know, Clockwork Orange or Dr. Strangelove, right the way through to Eyes Wide Shut. And yeah, so as I say, if you are ever interested in doing that and you're listening to this, Kubrick is a fantastic starting point, I think, to look at a director with that distinctive style without, you know, the movies being, I don't think, all that prohibitive. But having said that, my first experience with 2001, I actually didn't really like it at all. I was just talking to Ken off air and said I was just way too young for it. I was at that age where I'd started to get more and more into science fiction. So I liked my Star Trek, obviously. I'd watched the original with my mom and stuff. And I probably had by that point had seen Star Wars and been wowed by it. And just decided, you know, oh, I'll give this a go. And I think it was probably on Channel 4 or something. That I decided I would sit down and watch it. And because I was too young for it, I just, like a lot of people that I actually found when I was looking at the kind of critical response on IMDb, or the audience response, I should say, a lot of people do find it really slow, boring, and they just don't get it. And that was my experience because I was just too young for it, and I didn't really give it the time to sit with me. And because it was on Channel 4, it was cut to shreds and broken up with adverts every kind of 20 to 30 minutes. So it wasn't the ideal kind of way to watch the film anyway. So yeah, it was weird because I kind of came away from that thinking, oh, this film's overrated. And like I said, it's surprising seeing a lot of people on IMDb that have reviewed it. You know, it's one of the most divisive films. You'll find as many one-star reviews as you will five-star, which really shocked me. You know, people either get this and absolutely love it, or they just won't at all, and they just think this is a mess, it's overrated, I don't get it. But yeah, so hopefully we'll get more towards the, you know, the positive side of things. But yeah, I should say that what kind of turned me around on it was that I bought the DVD because it was in a sale or something at some point, and a friend of mine had told me that, you know, to give it a go by the time I had become a university student studying film, and they were like, no, you need to give it a go and give it a time, and you've got to get the proper uncut DVD and watch it. And I sat and watched it and was like, you know what, as an experience, when you sit down and you take your time and you let it, like Ken said, just wash over you, it's actually something just clicked, and it was fascinating to me, and it was like, this is actually amazing, and I really like it. And then I've seen it several times since then, and every time I see it, I'm just like, this is just brilliant. And as I said, I don't really understand the people that are like, even if you do want a more straightforward plot and you kind of insist on that, I don't know how you can disregard the visuals and just how gorgeous this thing is, just as kind of art on its own right, you know? So,
well, I always liked too that Kubrick doesn't infantilize his audience. You know, he gives us credit. I always liked that about his movies.
Yeah, and I mean, he's a filmmaker, you know, maybe it's partly the writing by him and Arthur C. Clarke and partly his direction, but he's a filmmaker that isn't in a hurry to get anywhere. He will take his time. Scenes that, you know, could be potentially cut or not, because, like, at the start of the film, there's a lot of focus, I think, on how space travel and things that we find wondrous have perhaps become a little bit mundane and a bit everyday. And so, you know, the sweeping operatic music as we've watched these thrilling special effects and things is juxtaposed with what looks just like, you know, a guy bored asleep on a transatlantic flight who's just doing the everyday. And you get the sort of flight attendant with their anti-gravity slippers or whatever, just saying to them, and then walking into a sort of corporatized hotel. And it's all kind of like, wow, we've kind of somehow eventually just made space travel and all these things just another trip to, you know, the equivalent of a trip to a mall or whatever. So, and like I said, Kubrick takes his time to show you that rather than, you know, just racing through the plot, as it were.
Yeah, if I could just jump in there, actually, because I have a good bit to say there. Actually, I was taking some notes. I mean, originally, when I think what people, if they're looking for a comparison, say, with The Shining, and they want to look at the 2001, and you want to see a link to it, you just have to look at the color tones, especially when the red is exactly the same color tone. If you were to look at the kind of the hashed number system that you'd find nowadays in any color scheme, you'll see that it's exactly the same red. Yeah, Kubrick was extremely anal about that, for the want of a better word. And then the other thing, I agree with you what you're saying there. I mean, the thing about it being divisive is that I think the problem is that it came at a time when there was no concept of science fiction before it. So, you know, you had the one that would probably come the closest to it would have been maybe Forbidden Planet. And if you look back on Forbidden Planet now, it kind of set the standard for, you know, it set the standard for two types of science fiction. So you had the kind of the guys in the uniforms and going around with the laser guns and all that kind of thing. And that went the Star Trek, Battlestar Galactica, Buck Rogers, all that kind of way. And then you had the idea of the creature in the movie itself on Forbidden Planet, that we never really kind of see it. It's kind of this, as was being talked about here, the fear of it was more important than the actual visual representation. And I think that was what you would get. That's what you got 2001: A Space Odyssey. And what happened then, that kind of won out, you know, because we're going back to what I was saying about the classic movies of the 70s, because they were cerebral science fiction. And then suddenly Star Wars came along. And I think the people who kind of went back to 2001 because they could get access to it either by a premiere, as I said earlier on, or either through the concept of VHS. I think what happens is they looked at it and they said, "Oh, this is not Star Trek. This is not Star Trek. This is not Star Wars. It's rubbish." But I think as time went on, and then we got the streaming services back online, and we were able to kind of say, look at science fiction in a much better way. So now you have people, you know, movies like The Creator now, for example. I mean, and Dune. I mean, all of these movies, you know, they owe thanks to this one. This film, you know, has kind of captured that audience back. So now people have so much choice. And I think what's happening is they're going back to 2001 because people like Villeneuve and, you know, all the great directors that are out now, they're kind of saying, oh, I like 2001 when they're being interviewed. So people go back and watch that and they go, oh, okay, I can see why The Creator was exactly like, you know, has a lot of concepts from 2001 where everything is kind of synced. And just to finish off, when you're talking about there, about, say, the boring banality of space travel, I think that was a brilliant conception by Kubrick, because it leads to the actual movie's real kind of subject matter. And it's about the fact that, you know, we think we've conquered space because it's boring, but actually there's a lot more out there that we will probably never ever know about. And that you was that concept. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that concept was the monolith, because they could touch Absolutely, it, yeah. they could see it, but they'll never understand it. So I think yeah. I think that was a deliberate thing from Kubrick to actually insert that kind of banality at the very start.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if I may, this may be just me, you know, reading too much into it, but I think personally it also, and it's another thing that Kubrick does, it also brings you into that reality a lot more, because in your kind of day-to-day life, it doesn't operate like a movie. You can't just think, this is a boring bit, let's get to the next part. And so you really are living in there from the very start to when you get to Discovery One. It feels like you're actually living it with the characters and you're on board there, and it brings that extra sense of reality and a bit more of an immersiveness to the experience of it, you know.
And he made a lot of effort to be realistic, to consult yeah. with Sagan oh, yeah. and so
oh,
on.
Oh yeah, I've gotten plenty of so notes definitely. On that. Yeah, yeah. yeah, for sure. But I do think it helps a lot, because like I said, and I think part of it was or part of the issue I think at present that I tried to identify was that maybe people just don't have the attention span for it, and, you know, TikTok generation and whatever else. But then as I was sitting and thinking about it, I was like, do you know what? If anybody complains about sitting through this for 2.5 hours, but they can be bored stupid by James Cameron for a solid 4 hours and his stupid yeah. blue people, then, yeah. you know.
I actually think, again, that's deliberate by Kubrick, right? Because what he did was, it's a minimalist film with a very, very deep yeah. storyline. But the actual yeah. direction and the style of the movie is minimalist. So in other words, yeah. what you see on the screen is what you only need to see. There's no, excuse my English, but there's no bullshit. You know, there's no, yeah. like, as you say, people having talks that in real life people wouldn't talk about. So I particularly noticed as a child, but as a teenager, when I watched it the second and third time, I was quite fascinated by the conversation that Heywood Floyd had in the waiting area before he went to the moon, where he was talking to Smilslov. And, you know, Elena, the two.
You mean Rigby from Rising Damp, right?
Yes. Leonard Rossiter. Exactly. Yeah. And this is the thing, you know, and like what I really enjoyed about that scene was that it was very, very real.
But yeah, I think as well, another kind of keyword that kept floating into my head as I was watching this is a word that I first encountered from the late, great Richard Donner in the kind of behind the scenes for Superman, which is that he used to say, even if you're dealing with kind of something as fantastical as that, you know, alien that can fly and whatever else, you've got to have this thing verisimilitude where it has to feel real. You can't yeah. treat it as anything otherwise. And like I said, as I was watching the sort of start parts of 2001, I'm like, this space station that you're going to and everything, it doesn't feel fantastical and wow and whatever. I mean, it does as you're viewing it from the filmmaker's lens with the kind of operatic music. And then you go inside and like I said, it's like there's a Pacific Bell and another, you know, the Hilton Hotel Company, and there's that awkward, you know, you're sitting in an awkward conversation like 1,000 people in 1,000 bars, and you yeah. just think this is the dullest conversation in the world, but the filmmaker isn't cutting it. He's not just getting to the next point and splicing and giving you a clever edit, because the reality is if you're in that situation, you've got to just sit and weather that awkwardness, and then, you know, so like I said, it adds to that sense of reality, which makes the more fantastical things, I think, strike you as more real in that way. It makes them feel less like you're seeing something fake. But yeah, anyway, having a good discussion, but I'm without wanting to interrupt it and kind of stop it dead, I did have a little bit of behind the scenes information, which you kind of touched on some of it already, but it's just kind of stuff that I think is interesting to give you a bit of context, a bit of background for the film. And again, feel free to jump in if there's anything you wanted to add, you guys, or you wanted to say anything about this, so that it's not just me droning on. But yeah, so the screenplay, as we've already said, was written by Stanley Kubrick and sci-fi author Arthur C. Clarke. It was mainly inspired by Clarke's 1951 short story, The Sentinel, but does include other short stories by Clarke. He also published a novelization of the film, which was in part written concurrently with the screenplay, but wasn't released until after the film, and which is why you get, I think, very different endings to the book and the movie themselves. The film is noted for its scientifically accurate depiction of spaceflight, as Sandy was alluding to, plus pioneering special effects and ambiguous imagery. Critics also noted its exploration of themes like human evolution, technology, artificial intelligence, and the possibility of extraterrestrial life, which is all in there. Kubrick's decision to avoid the fanciful portrayals of space found in popular sci-fi films led him to seek more realistic and accurate depictions. Again, as we've already said, eventually he hired people who'd worked on actual NASA training videos and a video exhibit at the World's Fair. And actually, the actor Douglas Rain, who voices Hal, was the narrator of that video at the World's Fair, which is how Kubrick you found him and did cast him in the movie. So I love that. Just a bit of extra attention to it. So yeah, apparently he was fascinated with, you know, the realities of space travel, which I think you can see here. There's no kind of, everything feels so real. There's no bizarre, you know, hyperdrive warp speed or whatever else. So, yeah.
Can I just come in there, actually? Sorry. Yeah, no. There's a quick one, obviously. We would have never, you know, we have these people who are, you know, the flat earthers and all those kind of people who say that we never went to the moon. And, you know, the actual success of that, this movie, 2001, in its special effects and cinematography, that gave them, like, the ultimate excuse to say that it was faked. Because anytime that, you know, you used to talk to them, they'd say, well, look at 2001. I mean, could you tell the difference? You know, so for a long, long time, they used that film as a tool to justify their nonsense.
It's also part of the kind of the, again, you'd be here all day, but part of the conspiracy theory that Kubrick filmed the supposedly fake moon landing. Yeah. It is incredible when you look at it on a special effects level or what the film was able to do, because as much as we love, for example, Star Trek, let's be honest, they were clearly in, you know, Paramount Stage 6 with an orange, you know, wall backdrop whenever they went to another planet. And yet this 1968, you know, during the run of Star Trek, and it's like they've gone to the moon. It's really there, you know?
It's so incredible.
Again, just incredible. Yeah, just great.
And it inspired it inspired so many things.
The last thing I had just kind of before I get into like the specific categories, the original cut of this movie was apparently 160 minutes long. Kubrick insisted, though, that the cuts that he made no significant difference, and he had the footage destroyed. Despite this, in December 2010... Douglas Trumbull announced that Warner Brothers had found 17 minutes of lost footage perfectly preserved in a Kansas salt mine vault that was used for storage. As of yet, no plans have been announced for the rediscovered footage.
Wow.
I'm just going to leave that hanging there. So,
yeah, you could put that. I mean, imagine this movie in an IMAX cinema with those extra 17 minutes.
Oh, yeah. And I will, I should say, in case anybody's playing the drinking game, and for Sandra's benefit, by the way, that if you watch this on 4K, which I did because I bought the 4K of it, my word, it's gorgeous. It just looks incredible. So, yeah, I can definitely recommend the 4K transfer and upgrade for this one. I kind of wanted to talk a little bit more. We already have been, but a little bit more about the specific writing and the plot of the movie. And again, I have a little bit just about the background of how it came together. We know kind of the people involved. But yeah, apparently Kubrick was convinced that Arthur C. Clarke was, in his words, a recluse, a nut who lives in a tree. But he allowed mutual acquaintance Roger Karras to cable the film proposal to Clarke. Clarke's cable response stated that he was, quote, frightfully interested in working with that enfant terrible, and also added, what makes Kubrick think I'm a recluse? So, yeah, they worked together for a long time trying to get the script in shape for this, and Clarke kept a diary throughout his involvement, excerpts of which were published in 1972 as The Lost Worlds of 2001. So I can't say I've read that, but Ken, I'm gonna ask, have you read it?
No, but I've just taken a note of it, and I'm just going to order it in my library if they probably have it. You never know. So
yeah,
that'd be brilliant. I've read all of Clark's books. I've never heard of that one though, so that's a new one. Yeah, learn every
day. It's more of a kind of non-fiction, but the making of and how 2001 came out. Must be fun. I'd love to have a hold of it now that I know it exists.
I'll let you know if I have it.
Cool. So yeah, Kubrick told Clark he wanted to make a film about man's relationship to the universe, and was, in Clark's words, determined to create a work of art which would arouse the emotions of wonder or, even if appropriate, terror, which again, we see he succeeded. Clark offered Kubrick six of his short stories, and by May 1964, Kubrick chose The Sentinel, as we've said, as the source material for the film. But in search of more material to expand the plot, the two spent the rest of 1964 reading books on science and anthropology, screening sci-fi films, and brainstorming ideas. They created the final plot for 2001 by integrating several different short story plots by Clarke, along with new plot segments that were requested by Kubrick for the film. And Clarke said that his 1953 story, Encounter in the Dawn, inspired the film's Dawn of Man sequence. So, yeah, there's a lot of information and a lot of background you could find, I think, that might have went into this film if you're an Arthur C. Clarke fan, which I love a couple of his books, particularly Childhood's End, but I can't say I've had that deep of a dive into it. So,
yeah, generally, I think I remember reading an article about this, about people went to see the movie originally in 1969, 1970. They were completely thrown by the actual first 15 minutes. They thought they were in the wrong movie, and people were like literally getting up and checking. I was coming to see a science fiction film, and there's a movie in there with like apes. What's going on? You know, because naturally people were thinking, is this Planet of the Apes? Have I gone into the wrong movie?
Yeah. It's amazing. As I watched it this time around, I was amazed that, and again, it's tantamount to the kind of filmmaker Kubrick is, that it's a solid 20 minutes, and it's a long time before you get into the point of being there, the monolith and everything. It's just, it takes its time showing you like the day-to-day life of, you know, the apes of the Dawn of Man, and them being stalked by jungle cats and their day-to-day
life. And of course, the issue there is that trailers wouldn't have been as diversely, you know, around.
It's one of the things, though, and again, it's an example of the kind of authorship, I suppose, of Kubrick, that scene, amongst others, has become so iconic that, I mean, if you watched Barbie last year, it's the start of that movie, which you would never expect. And it's referencing 2001 with the idea that the very first Barbie is the monolith and the kids are smashing the old baby dollies and things in the way that the skulls are getting smashed. And there's a fantastic, I'll probably link it in the comments, there's a fascinating kind of video essay that just came out by a critic that I love called Maggie Mayfish, who basically identified an awful lot of Kubrick influence in Barbie. And she makes a really compelling case with tons of examples, and it's truly fascinating, and I think it makes you appreciate both Kubrick and Greta Gerwig as filmmakers a heck of a lot more when you can see kind of things that you might have missed. But again, not here to talk about Barbie, I guess, of all things. I will say Kubrick selected the title 2001 A Space Odyssey because he intended to set the film apart from the, quote, monsters and sex type of sci-fi films of the time, which again, Ken said that's basically what we had. He used Homer's The Odyssey as both a model of literary merit and a source of inspiration for the title. And Kubrick said, it occurred to us that for the Greeks, the vast stretches of the sea must have had the same sort of mystery and remoteness that space has for our generation. Yeah, I think that's probably fair, and I can see where he's coming from with that. Regarding the ambiguity in the film script, which we should probably touch on, Kubrick was quoted in a 1968 Playboy interview, yes, they do articles as well, as saying, how much would we appreciate the Mona Lisa today if Leonardo had written at the bottom of the canvas, this lady is smiling slightly because she has rotten teeth or because she's hiding a secret from her lover. It would shut off the viewer's appreciation and shackle them to a reality other than their own, and I don't want that to happen to 2001. Yeah, that's kind of what I mean. I think the extra reality means that you're able to bring something of your own to it in the way that you can with art, and I compare this film a lot to, you know, some people will go to an art gallery and be like, I don't get it, what's this, what does this mean, and some people will, you know, think that they can identify the secrets of the universe in every piece they look at and every picture they see, and I love that there's layers of meaning that you can ascribe to this. Kubrick's not interested in holding your hand, I think, during this movie, and this means that, so yeah, I kind of love that. Kubrick has said about the film that it's basically a visual, non-verbal experience that hits the viewer at an inner level of consciousness, just as music does, or painting, which again, kind of like I think of that. He said the nature of the mysterious unseen alien race was a suggestion that given millions of years of evolution, they progressed from biological beings to immortal machine entities, and then into beings of pure energy and spirit with limitless capabilities and ungraspable intelligence. In a 1980 interview that was not released during Kubrick's lifetime, he explains that one of the film's closing scenes, where Bowman is depicted in old age after his journey through the Stargate, he said the idea was supposed to be that he's taken in by these entities, creatures of pure energy and intelligence with no shape or form. They put him in what I suppose you could describe as a human zoo to study him, and his whole life passes from that point on in that room. And he has no sense of time. When they get finished with him, as happens in so many myths of all cultures in the world, he's transformed into some kind of super being and sent back to Earth as some kind of Superman. We have to only guess what happens when he goes. It's the pattern of a great deal of mythology, and that is what we were trying to suggest. So, yeah, what do you guys think about that? The kind of that really weird kind of end sequence and the beyond the infinite stuff.
I think it was just meant to kind of, well, shift perspective and give you the sense that you are going on a journey, you're going to a totally different place, and to kind of like have you take a stress pill and think about things.
Yeah. But what I mean, like, because that turns out, again, Kubrick's in no rush to get to what the point of the main plot is, but ultimately the through line is this monolith, and that is the central plot, and yet it doesn't really give you an answer. It hits you with this surreal, trippy experience and these things that you can interpret a bunch of different ways, and I'd just love to know you guys' experience of that and what you could perhaps bring to it. Anything, Sandy, from your end?
Well, yeah, that's what I bring from it. Like, the first monolith, it just, to me, it didn't do anything really except be there and make the monkey think, well, if there can be this thing here. Maybe there can be other things somewhere else. You know, it was just simply a paradigm shift, a perspective change, which made him start looking at his environment in a different way. And yeah. I think the second monolith did that also. They're like, if this is here, what could be just beyond? And yeah. they started to look outward. And I think that's also what the trippy sequence did, was just was a perspective change. It said, you know, this movie has been, you know, grounded as well as it can be. There's the science more than the fiction. But now we're about to get, you know, outside of reality, and I need you to think a little bit differently.
Yeah. And what about you, Ken?
I would agree with that. And I think if I could add to it, the Stargate scene, I think, was probably a technical issue. So they wouldn't, you, if you tried to pull that off nowadays, first of all, you'd be limited by time. They'd probably cut it down to a minute or so. You just couldn't, you know, try and present that in a movie and get away with it for it to be so long. So I think the Stargate issue was just something that he wanted to do from a visual perspective. I don't think it has any sense of meaning to add to the movie. In the book, it's a Stargate, so that's all you see. And in the book, there's a little bit more detail about how he travels and he can see things. So there's a little bit more of a description, all right, but it's still a Stargate. So I think the end sequence is very, very interesting, because what happens about that is that, you know, there's a fluidic ending to it. In other words, you can take everything out of it, but the bottom line is you're not alone anymore and you can't feck around. And that was the thing. I think this was the Star Child sort of meaning that, hi, guys, you know, we're saying hello. We're keeping an eye on you. Don't mess it up, you know, because we may have to intervene. And what it also showed was it immediately tied into the opening sequence in that they've had a hand in everything we've done so far. So it's a real open, it's an eye opener in that respect. They've been guiding us to this moment. And I don't want to make this podcast about, say, the second movie that came after. There was an attempt at an explanation on that as well. Mm-hmm. In that, while the movie ended in 2001, it was really just the beginning. So I think the whole idea was him going to old age, dying, and then boom, boom, reset. You know, he's back again as an infant or as an embryo. So I think there was a lot of meanings in the end of that movie, and. Like Sandy said, you can take a lot of different perspectives, but it was a change of perspective as well at the end. And I don't think people were used to that, to be honest, in 1969. I think they like to have da-da, da-da-da-da-da, and that's it, you know, roll credits. And, you know, they don't think they were used to that. So I don't think they could analyze it in the way that people can analyze it now, probably, because we have so many more movies like that. There's been, you know, some of the great sci-fi movies have just ended on a note where you're going, what? You know, so you know, I think it set the tone and set the pace for all of those movies, but I think the ending it shows, really, to sum up, the ending is that it's not the ending; it's actually a beginning. That's why you see the embryo.
Absolutely. I mean, it is in a lot of ways rebirth, as you said, and you know, a lot of the themes that I identified throughout the film are, it's a lot of its time is concerned with themes of life and death. There's mention at least twice of somebody's birthday, whether it's the little girl at the start or Pool on Squirt. Discovery One.
Yeah, Squirt.
and I was like, there's got to be a reason why it's somebody's birthday on two different occasions. And it just occurred to me, birth, life, death. This is the cycle. This is, you know, whether it be a person or the universe or whatever. And I did want to kind of put forward this theory, again, without wanting to say this is the definitive meaning and ascribe it to it. And I can't remember where I saw it, but a few critics, I think, have made this connection, and it might be made more explicit in the book, which I've not read. But some people have speculated that the monolith is basically, the opening scene is showing that the monolith basically kickstarted evolution. It made the, you know, those apes get a level of intelligence and work out tools and things. And that the second monolith is basically doing the same thing. It's kickstarting us to the next stage of human evolution, where we would become, you know, energy beings or the Star Child or whatever else you want to call it. So I think that interpretation is fascinating. And again, it's grounds it so much in the rest of the film that I think when you take that from it, it's like, wow, you know, these are big sci-fi ideas that you're able to deal with on this broad canvas. And I love it. I have to say,
I would agree with you 100% on that. That's why I was saying to you that they've been here with us all along and they're guiding us along. And, you know, every time we kind of step out of line, something happens. Again, I'm not going to refer back to 2001, but just 2001. But the sequel explains that a lot, because there's an incident at the end, and you know, we look like we're on the verge of self destruction, and then something happens with the monolith that changed that. So yeah, I think the directors of the second sequel got that idea, but it took a long time. Yeah. It took a long time for everyone else kind of to get that idea. I think if you go to, you know, if you're in film school anywhere around the world, you know, these are must watch films, and you've got to watch them from a director's point of view rather than a fan or a viewer's type of view. And I think a lot of directors do that.
Yeah. And I will say, I think I prefer the ambiguity of this ending without the sequel, having read a little bit about what happens in it without seeing it.
Yeah.
I think I prefer this standing on its own and the more ambiguous ending there of what happens to Dave and such. But I should mention, obviously, one of the most famous things on a director's point of view, without wanting to skip too far ahead, is the famous match cut at the start of the scene as we switch from the Dawn of Man to, you know, the year 2001 or whatever the future is, where it shows the bone spinning, which then becomes the sort of satellite, whatever you want to call it, which I didn't realize is apparently supposed to be a kind of weapon, like a satellite nuclear weapon type thing. And again, related to the kind of theme that you said of like we're being watched and, you know, people are trying to get us beyond our petty differences and whatever. Initially, the initial draft of the film had ended with the Star Child basically detonating all of these nuclear weapons and things in orbit and effectively, you know, rendering us without this destructive power. But Kubrick didn't want to do that because, in his own words, he said it was too similar to the ending of Dr. Strangelove, which he'd just done. So you lose a little bit of that there, but that's fascinating that you can still kind of see the point, I think, of it in the film. It's there's a kernel of it there, even if you don't go there. So again, just fascinating stuff and so much you could look at and take away from the writing and the direction. Did you guys have anything else you wanted to mention about the kind of writing and the plot before I move to specific direction that we've got to talk?
I just think it's amazing that we've done like nearly 35 minutes and haven't mentioned the you know, the biggest protagonist of them all, you know. So yeah, and I'm looking forward to the next page when we finally get to hear, I'm sorry I can't do that, Dave, you know. So
yeah, Hal, and I mean, it's one of the themes that we touched on, and that's one of the things that fascinates me, is that like This film can be broken down into three acts, which is like, as it more or less says on screen, the Dawn of Man, then the kind of futuristic space science fiction movie, which is a bit more straightforward, then Jupiter and Beyond the Infinite. And the story that it's telling is, again, it's a fascinating one. And I think a lot of people that maybe, you know, write off the film or call it boring, don't realize how seminal this idea was of like artificial intelligence that's developed its own sentience and supposed to be flawless, but doesn't have that respect for life. And as Sandra said, the potentially terrifying consequences of like, oh, this thing controls everything and it wants to kill us. You know, these are huge themes that sci-fi deals with from the Terminator onwards that started off here. These were the first ones to speculate about that. And it's fascinating. And again, that's a very straightforward thing that you can look at, even if you don't want to have the ambiguity or whatever, that, you know, you can take away themes and stuff. And it is. It's fascinating. And it's become iconic. The shots, the speeches, the way that the single kind of red eye is so ominous. The way that Douglas Rain's voice has that eerie kind of stoic quality to it that just unsettles you. So, yeah. And Sandra, you're the one that brought it up. So I have to say, like, you obviously were affected by this, the kind of HAL 9000 plotline.
Yeah, actually from the beginning, even I found the monkeys when they were screaming at each other to be quite frightening. Right. But then moving on to how, yes, just the helplessness in that situation, and that he, you know, how had so much control that he was being so manipulative and devious, and that AI could be that, it was quite frightening.
Yeah. And I mean, the fallibility of AI, the idea that like we in our hubris, I guess, thought we've created this thing that's flawless and cannot go wrong. And yet, you know, it did, because there's such a thing as thinking, I guess, thinking that you're impervious as a creator, I guess, could potentially be another foible that you could fall into. And again, it touches on these bigger themes, but it's fascinating. And then as a kind of related to that, the way that HAL says so sincerely, you know, it's got to be attributable to the human error. It's always human error. In that kind of like, whoa, that's kind of terrifying in a way. What you think about it is like him saying, it's because you're inferior. You know, it's
that
scary,
classic thought experiment when it comes to AI, like when you tell AI to do whatever it takes to save the human race, and it ends up killing everybody because, you know, we're destroying ourselves, you know, that kind of thing. It, and like how his, the fault in his computer could be, if one wanted to interpret it that way, up to human, a programming error where we programmed how to keep the mission a secret no matter what, you know. Absolutely. And that was the outcome.
And again, that's something that you see in films from, you know, the, from Terminator, you know, humanity's creation of Skynet, which then ultimately decides people are a problem and wants to nuke us into non-existence. Or like, excuse me, to give you a kind of blockbuster example. Sorry, one second. Excuse me, sorry about that. It's a good job I edit these. Coughing fit, excuse me.
It's not funny, but I've had that before. You just take in a breath and it gets caught in your trachea. I know what you're going through.
I was having a coughing fit, but I was trying to mute it at the same time, both in my actual gullet and then via the computer. But no. So as I was saying, if you want like a recent blockbuster example, look at like Age of Ultron, even touching on those themes of like, we want to create something that can protect the whole world. And then it comes online and says, you're the problem, buddy. We just want to eradicate you. That'll protect everything. So yeah, and these are things that started, that originated here. So yeah, love it.
I think the elements, you know, in the books explain in a bit more detail what was the theory behind Hal's thinking. And I think, Sandra, you touched on it there. It's just a case of like him not being allowed to lie. And I think this was the issue. He couldn't lie. So when he was being hit with contradictive issues, he tried to cancel the actual communication. And that's why he knocked off the AE unit. And, you know, he was saying to the guys, oh, I don't know, it's very strange. You know, but what he was trying to do was give them a chance, you know. And then he was kind of saying, look, I'm not sure where my position is on this. I'm lying to one people and then I'm lying to others. So, I think, you know, again, the book explains him. The books explain it in a little bit more detail. But just to finish on that, that wasn't necessary for 2001. You didn't have to know that, because what you were looking at was the end result of his programming. So it wasn't about, it was this kind of sub story that probably kept people sitting in the cinema who might have said, "Fuck this, I'm leaving." You know, this is a really boring movie. So, you know, it was that kind of subplot that was required in a movie.
What fascinated me was that it seems at first to be not linked to the main idea and the main plot of this movie.
Yeah.
Until I examined it a bit closer and was like, no, it's thematically exactly the same kind of thing. It's artificial life, but it is still about, you know, life that has been created by people rather than, you know, evolved or triggered by whatever other alien intelligence. And that is now reaching a next step in its evolution as it starts to gain its own sentience. And, you know, even that little conversation they have about, like, would you say Hal has feelings? Well, he's programmed to mimic them. But if you're asking me, does that mean they're really there or just really good programmed to, you know, to give us a more human interaction? These are fascinating questions. And again, it's dealing with them via AI, because sci-fi can do that. But it's kind of the same questions that are being asked on a macro level about humanity itself. You know, are we ready to evolve to that next step? Will we be a threat if we do it to ourselves or other people or other life, whatever? So I just thought that was brilliant when you actually sort of stop and think why it's in the film. And it's not just there to be like, well, we need a little bit of action or whatever. It links to,
but I do think though that was an element to it as well, though. You know, if you wanted to create the actual proper meaning behind the story of Hal, it would have been done very differently. So I mean, look, you know, it was 1968, so every movie still needed something. You know, you couldn't just go in as an art house movie.
It did go also give it the creep factor, though. You know, Kubrick said he wanted you to feel the movie as opposed to literally anything else. And so that definitely set the tone, I think, for the next part.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. Yeah.
Yeah. And again, I'm ascribing meaning to this thing because that's how I see it. I'm not saying that's the only way to view it, absolutely. And you want to bring something else to it, that's fair enough. But I do think it's fascinating that it seems like it's a separate story. But it's part of this whole, and it's there for a reason, I think, as well. You've got to sort of think it's not just a question of we're dealing with this monolith story and then we're going to pause that while we deal with this, you know, rogue computer story for a little bit.
But he did that with his titles a bit, didn't he? Kind of set it into like a series of stories. connected.
Yeah. Yeah, but I do think they are connected. I think it's not intended to be like three separate vignettes that are telling three different sci-fi stories. I think they are meant to be linked, you know, otherwise it wouldn't be necessarily one film. It would be a series of shorts. But again, that's kind of the beauty of it, is if you can, if you want to interpret it that way, fair enough. If you don't, you can look for a deeper meaning. And ultimately, we're never going to know, because that's how art works. You can bring your own baggage to it, I guess, in some ways, if you want. So, yeah. Cool.
I mean, the other thing about the movie is that it does lack a kind of human, a bit of a soul. I mean, that if the only critic, if the only criticism I was to lay on that film is that it lacks a bit of soul. Like, for example, you're kind of watching when Poole is in his is in the dire straits, the reactions and the behavior by his, so you know, his co-pilot is very banal, very banal. You know, it's like, there's not really the.
Oh, I have a bit about that. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I mean, I can maybe that was the style that he probably introduced. I've never looked into it in that deep motion, but looking back on it now, I'm a little more forgiving than I would have been when I first saw it a few times.
Yeah. Now that you mention it, everybody's very unexcited about these discoveries, and when the main character's outside of the ship and, you know, possibly facing his own end, he's very cool, calm, and collected. So now that you mention that, it does definitely seem intentional.
Yeah. If I may, I have a bit about that, but it's kind of like, I gathered it from a few different sources and kind of cross-referenced. It's the only note I have about the acting, because like I said, there's not a ton of acting in the movie. You know, Kubrick spends a lot of time without dialogue, or, you know, not dealing with people in that way. And I would say the acting performances apparently are notable because they're subtle and understated. And unlike traditional Hollywood films where actors will dominate the screen with an emotive performance, the actors in 2001 deliver more restrained, to be naturalistic portrayal. And this approach aligns with Kubrick's vision of portraying a future where technology and the vastness of space overshadow the human characteristics. And additionally, the lack of overt emotional display adds to the film's enigmatic and contemplative atmosphere, allowing viewers to project their own interpretations onto the characters and the themes. And Keir Duller's portrayal of Dave Bowman stands out because of his quiet determination, as you said, and his gradual unraveling as he confronts the mysteries of the monolith and the AI HAL. And overall, the performances have been said by some to contribute to the film's timeless and transcendent quality. So I think it is a deliberate choice, and I think for all those reasons it is. It might seem to us like they're not, that they're a bit uninterested, or they're, I guess, sleepwalking through it in some ways.
Or just robotic, you know, they're kind of like robotic.
And that's kind of something that I noticed, is like, as you said, they seem robotic, so that when you have Hal, in some ways there are moments when he feels more emotional and more, you know, more sympathetic than the human characters, particularly when they're basically killing him. But again, I don't want to get too far into that, because I kind of touch on that a little bit later on. But yeah, I think
you know, it could be something as simple as Kubrick saying, like, you know, just feck it, like, we'll just do it that way, you know, because I mean, we can sometimes overthink his reasons for a certain direction in his movies, but I think a lot of it, you know, I've read many times the man had a very strong sense of humor, so he did like to kind of piss off the audiences a little bit. So maybe this was kind of something along the lines that he thought he could do, where he could say, like, okay guys, you need to be more robotic than the robots, you know you're like, you know, that's exactly what you're saying, David Hal, because you can certainly hear the emotion in some of his sentences. You know, the conflict that he was constantly in, relating to what I would have said earlier on. So yeah, I think maybe he did that because he wanted the humans to be, as you're saying there about the development of technology and so on, that they're losing a little bit of their soul.
I just really appreciated about it that it made me able to imagine what it felt like to really be in space in this time. And that's what I liked about all the details, the attention to science, and, you know, for example, being out in a spacewalk, all you would hear was your own breathing. And I just appreciated all that early detail and reality.
Yeah, I had that note under the sound, is that it's not just your breathing. It's, you can only hear your breathing and this kind of really annoying, almost dull, like whiny sound that's in the background, which I don't know if it was a deliberate, like, it's meant to be the space that's working or whatever. Or it could just have been my disc was faulty. I don't think so, though. I think it's there.
It's there.
Or it's meant to be, I don't know, the background radiation in space or whatever, but it's very much there. And it's kind of, again, it's a deliberate choice, whatever the reason behind it. But yeah, I think it's just incredible anyway. And yeah, I mean, sound design in general, we haven't even talked about it, but again, I'll talk about it perhaps a bit more later. The idea that to try and get across how kind of fantastic and epic this idea of space travel is, putting classical music and making, just adding to that beauty by having that audio element as we're looking at these great special effects. And again, the idea of juxtaposing that with just, oh, I'm having a boring, mundane, you know, do you want a drink? No, it's too early for me. I'll go and chat with my daughter on video phone. And, you know, somebody living a complete workaday life in this thing that we think of as, wow, what a spectacle. But yeah, again, that could just be me, but that's kind of certainly what I take away from those early bits. But yeah, I mean, talking about the direction, though, as I kind of was starting to there, Kubrick, as we'll know if you've seen the film, avoided conventional cinematic and narrative techniques. Dialogue is used very sparingly, and there's long sequences accompanied either by silence or just music. The methods used to, this is a particular kind of behind the scenes story I wanted to share, so indulge me because it's kind of, I don't know, I find it weirdly amusing in a way, but it's also you know, potentially evidence against Kubrick as not a particularly nice person, which mounts up more and more if you kind of hear any behind-the-scenes stories. So, yeah, the methods used to simulate weightlessness were alleged to have placed the stuntman Bill Weston's life in danger. Weston recalled that he filmed one sequence without air holes in his suit, risking asphyxiation. Even when the tank was feeding air into the suit, there was no place for the carbon dioxide Weston exhaled to go. So it simply built up inside, incrementally causing a heightened heart rate, rapid breathing, fatigue, clumsiness, and eventually unconsciousness. Wow. Weston said Kubrick was warned, "We've got to get him back," but reportedly replied, "Damn it, we just started. Leave him up there." When Weston lost consciousness, filming ceased and he was brought down. They brought in his own words here. "They brought the tower in and I went looking for Stanley. I was going to shove MGM right up his." And the thing is, Stanley had left the studio and sent Victor Lyndon, associate producer, to talk to me. Weston claimed Kubrick fled the studio for 2 or 3 days and said, "I know he didn't come in the next day, and I'm sure it wasn't the day after, because I was going to do him." I mean, genius at the expense of kind of human life is perhaps a stretch too far. And yeah, we'd be here all day going into things like, you know, poor Shelley Duvall and all that. And, you know, the way Kubrick would, to try and get this naturalistic performance, would exhaust his actors by doing take after take after take, which again might be part of the reason why these actors in this film seem just exhausted and drained.
Yeah, I think, though, that method of direction is it's very much gone. You know, I don't see it in modern movie making, you know?
I mean, yeah, it's not our place. We're here to analyze the actual movies as opposed to the making ofs. But yeah, I mean, do your due diligence and perhaps acknowledge that a lot of this was at the expense of people, I think, at times. But yeah. But yeah, anyway, so that was kind of, I don't want to talk too much more about, or at all really, about the direction, because I've kind of talked my thoughts on it. And I've been talking way too long. So just before I move us, completely away from it, Sandra, for example, did you have any thoughts on Kubrick's direction of 2001 that you wanted to bring up or that we might not have touched on yet?
I don't think anything that you might not have touched on yet. I just really did appreciate the understated actors in it. It drew me in and just made me think of them as capable and that... that this just wasn't that exciting to them or that crazy to them. I don't know. It just kind of grounded the whole first part of the film.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. And what about you, Ken? Anything we hadn't brought up yet?
No, I would agree with Sandra 100% there, because the problem, you only have to look at the actual lineup in that film in terms of the cast. There's very few kind of well-known actors. And I think that was the whole point. He just didn't give a hoot. I think he was more concerned about blending them in to the overall movie. And going back to what I was saying to you, that by the mid-80s, early 90s, you had actors who were kind of rinse and repeat actors doing the same type of films, and they were bigger than the film all the time. So I think it was the opposite, complete opposite with 2001. I think you could have put a lot of people in those roles, and it would have made zero difference to the movie, I think, because the movie was a million times bigger than anyone who starred in it. In fact, I would say most people who would know about 2001 would have no idea who the actors were. They couldn't even mention them. They wouldn't even recognize them, actually. If you put a picture up in front of them and said, which of these three guys went through the Stargate, they're guaranteed to pick the wrong person. that's how unmemorable they were.
That's a deliberate thing, because I think Kubrick didn't want you having any of that baggage. Like somebody with a particular star persona would kind of trigger that in your mind, and he didn't want that. And a great example of like the reality he wanted is you mentioned earlier Squirt on the video phone.
Yes,
he didn't hire an actor for that part. That is daughter, Vivian Kubrick. Yeah, that's his daughter. That he was absolutely. He has the line. Just a couple of things I wanted to mention about the direction then, because I kind of found a couple of notes here. I'm amazed at how much everything has scale here. And again, it's part of the reality of it. So Kubrick, and again, he does this in all of his films. It's not specific to this, but the way he centers people in the frame and has like lots of space around them so that they feel part of like a larger whole, rather than like a lot of directors will just focus on the people that are talking and ignore the background. And Kubrick will, you know, he'll have them centered and then have a very obvious background there. That
there's a lot of beautiful symmetry too.
Yeah. A lot of symmetry as well, and a lot of depth of field. A great example that I thought when I was watching it is when they're sitting, like I said, having this mundane kind of bar chat about, you know, oh, is this it's an epidemic or something we need to know? And it's just that awkward conversation. The background that it specifically shows you behind Floyd just seems to go on forever and just, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's this chasm of, like, it's hinting at, like, this larger, huge world that still goes on. Even when we're having this dull conversation, you know?
Yeah, that's a great example. Is there people in the background walking around there? That would be interesting to actually look at that scene again.
I think you can kind of see it, and it seems to go on forever, and it's like doors to other places. So
was it a set art design then, I wonder? It probably was, you know, that the actual extent of it wasn't really that long, and it was just a good painting.
I think it might have been like a rear projection type situation, because I know a lot of early techniques were used for stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I think, I mean, you know yourself, if you've studied film, that's a cheat, like, you know, they stick a mirror in front of a small thing and it seems to go on forever, and you've actually built, you know, 1/8 of the set.
it's a great, really great example though. You know, I mean, that's a brilliant example of what you just talked about there, because now I want to go and watch that. Now I'm going to go off and watch that when we're finished and see, is there anyone in the background? Because then you'll get a scope of just how big it was.
Yeah, and it makes it feel like they're not on a set, they're actually in this space station.
Yeah.
You know, and you couple that with, like I said, the little details that I hadn't noticed, like the corporations that have places in this thing, as if it's just a mall.
Pan Am, Hojo's.
Half of them don't even exist anymore because it was 1960.
RIP Pan Am, yeah, it's crazy, you know, yeah.
The kind of last thing I want to talk to about, kind of with the making of the film and everything, before we hit kind of critics' response and give our own opinions, is the music and the sound, because I do think it's important. As you've said, Ken, you own the soundtrack, and the use of classical music, I think, is just perfectly done. It all seems to just fit. You know, we can't play any of it for rights reasons, but go watch the film. It's excellent. I promise. Always get the soundtrack.
Or just listen to the soundtrack. Yeah.
But I don't really have much else to say other than a couple of things, which was like that basically adds to the epic feel, as I've already said. And the other note I have on the sound is that the kind of rush of loud sound when Dave secures the hatch. And
yes, that's an excellent scene.
It's such a good moment because, as you said, his performance doesn't really give you the sense of danger or whatever.
Yeah.
And then you get this the culture shock of just like, you've already had Hal say, well, that would be very dangerous for you. You see the idea of that until this thing just whacks you in the face with the just silence and then whoomph. And, oh, God, is he all right? You know?
So this is the thing that people probably don't realize. It's like got people like Johann Strauss in it, for example. Mm. That's where you hear the big bright blue Danube and so on. And then, you know, they also Zach Sprach Zarusta. But the other thing that really struck me was Giorgio Ligeti's the use of his music atmospheres. Now, Ligeti is a Hungarian composer who had you know, been very, very avant-garde in the late 50s and early 60s. That's the kind of that scary sound that Sandra was talking about, that all the time in it. So, like, it was actually just a choir of people. Like, and if you listen to the very first Alien movie, that is used in a similar sense as well. And the connection there is that because Jerry Goldsmith had oversaw, you know, the overall production of the soundtrack for 2001. And of course, Jerry Goldsmith did the music for the first Alien soundtrack.
Yeah.
So
we did a lot.
Pulled a lot, exactly. And this is why I'm saying to you, like, the influences almost go beyond the direction and style of the movie, but also the soundtrack. And again, I don't think anybody had any concept of, say, for example, the silence that happened when he was trying to get through the airlock. And as you say, suddenly the air came in, because people didn't realize that was real. That's how it sounds. Yeah. And of course, didn't they use that tagline, an alien in space, no one can hear you scream? So, you know, a lot of those, I know I'm probably reaching a little bit, but still it gets you thinking about those things. And when you watch those movies, and if you're as kind of interested in 2001 as we all are, you can draw a lot of influences into the other movies. They must be connected. They have to be connected.
There's this one point in the movie where the music crescendos and it gets so loud and then it just immediately drops off and you and just silence and you feel like you've lost your footing in that moment.
That's brilliant, Sandra. Yeah. That's a great. I'm gonna steal that actually for many other things.
Yeah, but I think that's the point. Is that it? Like you said, this all is to evoke feelings in you, and that's definitely the way the usage of visuals, the usage of music, everything, even right down to, I should mention, as I said, the horrible sound that the monolith makes.
Yes, that's Giorgio Ligeti's Atmospheres. I would strongly advise that you go on to YouTube and just click in Atmospheres and you'll hear it, and it will scare the bejesus out of you if you just turn off all the lights and just put your head down and listen to it on headphones. You know, it's got that actual sense of dread and fear. And actually, that was never intended to do that music, because I'm quite familiar with that music, you know, and that composer myself. It's a very small part of a very grand scheme that he created, but on its own, it's scary as hell.
Yeah, awesome. It adds to the unsettling idea of what is this thing. But I'm going to move us along to the next bit anyway. So the next thing that we do, as I say, if you are new to us or you haven't seen the cinema classics, I don't do an audience response because, you know, it felt like it might be redundant if I'm looking at some of these classic films. You know, some of them might just be universally acclaimed or whatever. I could have done that on this one, like I said, but we've touched on it. You know, all you need to know is there's a range of opinions. But I'm always fascinated when it comes to these classics of the critics' opinion, contemporary and modern. And just so you're not listening to me droning anymore, I did email the information on this one over to Sandra. So you're going to have to listen to her dulcet tones instead. So Sandra, do you have the critics' response to 2001 there, along with maybe a couple of, I think, fun stories that I chucked in?
Yes, I'm ready.
Cool, go for it.
So the critics' response for 2001 A Space Odyssey, it polarized critical opinion, receiving both praise and derision, with many New York-based critics being especially harsh. Kubrick called them dogmatically atheistic and materialistic and earthbound. Some critics viewed the original 160-minute cut shown at premieres. Keir Dulla said that during the New York premiere, 250 people walked out. In L.A., Rock Hudson not only left early, but was heard to mutter, "What is this bullshit? So someone please tell me what the heck this is about?" But a few months into the release, they realized a lot of people were watching it while smoking funny cigarettes. Someone in San Francisco even ran right through the screen screaming, "It's God!" So they came up with a new poster that said, "2001, the ultimate trip." In The New Yorker, Penelope Gilliatt said, "It was some kind of great film and an unforgettable endeavor. The film is hypnotically entertaining, and it is funny without once being gaggy, but it is also rather harrowing." Charles Champlin of the Los Angeles Times wrote that it was the picture that science fiction fans of every age and in every corner of the world have prayed, sometimes forlornly, that the industry might someday give them. It is an ultimate statement of the science fiction film, an awesome realization of the spatial future. It is a milestone, a landmark in the art of film. Louise Sweeney of the Christian Science Monitor felt that 2001 was a brilliant intergalactic satire on modern technology. It's also a dazzling 160-minute tour on the Kubrick film ship through the universe out there beyond our Earth. The Boston Globe's review called it the world's most extraordinary film. Nothing like it has ever been shown before. The film is as exciting as the discovery of a new dimension in life. Roger Ebert gave the film 4 stars in his original review, saying the film succeeds magnificently on a cosmic scale. He later put it on his top 10 list for sight and sound. Stanley Kaufman of the New Republic described it as a film that is so dull, it even dulls our interest in the technical ingenuity for the sake of which Kubrick has allowed it to become dull. The Soviet director Andrei Tarkovsky found the film to be an inadequate addition to the science fiction genre of filmmaking. Renata Adler of the New York Times wrote that it was somewhere between hypnotic and immensely boring. Variety's Robert B. Frederick believed it was a big, beautiful, but plodding sci-fi epic. a major achievement in cinematography and special effects, 2001 lacks dramatic appeal to a large degree and only conveys suspense after the halfway mark. Andrew Saris called it one of the grimmest films I have ever seen in my life. 2001 is a disaster because it is much too abstract to make its abstract points. Saris reversed his opinion upon a second viewing and declared 2001 is indeed a major work by a major artist. John Simon felt it was a regrettable failure, although not a total one. This film is fascinating when it concentrates on apes or machines and dreadful when it deals with the in-betweens, humans. 2001, for all its lively visual and mechanical spectacle, is a kind of space Spartacus, and more pretentious still, a Shaggy God story.
someone flogged him for that pun.
Yeah.
Historian Arthur M. Schlesinger Jr. deemed the film morally pretentious, intellectually obscure, and inordinately long, a film out of control. In a 2001 review, the BBC said that its slow pacing often alienates modern audiences more than it did upon its initial release. On review aggregator Rotten Tomatoes, the film has a rating of 92% based on 118 reviews, with an average rating of 9.2 out of 10. The website's critical consensus reads, one of the most influential of all sci-fi films and one of the most controversial. Stanley Kubrick's 2001 is a delicate, poetic meditation on the ingenuity and folly of mankind. Review aggregator Metacritic, which uses a weighted average, has assigned the film a score of 84 out of 100 based on 25 critic reviews. 2001 was the only science fiction film to make Sight and Sound's 2012 list of the 10 best films and tops the online Film Critics Society list of greatest science fiction films of all time. In 2012, the Motion Picture Editors Guild listed it as the 19th best edited film of all time based on a survey of its membership. Other lists that include the films are 50 Films to See Before You Die, where it ranks number 6, The Village Voice 100 Best Films of the 20th Century, where it ranks at number 11, and Roger Ebert's Top 10 of 1968, where it falls in at number 2. In 1995, the Vatican named it one of the 45 best films ever made. That's unexpected. And included it in a sublist of the top 10 art movies of all time. In 1998, Time Out conducted a reader's poll, and 2001 A Space Odyssey was voted as 9th on the list of greatest films of all time. Entertainment Weekly voted it number 26 on their list of 100 greatest movies of all time. In 2017, Empire Magazine's reader's poll ranked it 21st on its list of the 100 greatest movies. In the Sight and Sound poll of 480 directors published in December 2022, 2001 A Space Odyssey was voted as the greatest film of all time, ahead of Citizen Kane and The Godfather. Nominated for 4 Academy Awards, winning Kubrick the award for his direction of the visual effects, the film is now widely regarded as one of the greatest and most influential films ever made. In 1991, it was selected by the United States Library of Congress for preservation in the National Film Registry.
Wow. Thanks for that, Sandra. Yeah. I gave you a lot to, quite a mouthful to get through there, but I just thought it was interesting to have the dual perspectives and yet see culturally just how important and how famous the film has become and how loved. I mean, one publication saying best film of all time ahead of, you know, mainstays like Citizen Kane, The Godfather, etc. It's just incredible.
And I don't recall if we had noted yet, but I'm sure we're all aware that it bombed initially in theaters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't know that, but yeah, I'm not surprised. Like I said, I think it's one of those where you kind of had to discover it for yourself, maybe. All that remains is for us to give our kind of last thoughts on this, favorite things, and our conclusions, and then we can get out of here. So as we do on all of the other Silver Screen regular podcasts, I'm going to go around and ask our favorite character, then our favorite moment, favorite line. So, Ken, who was your favorite character in the movie, and maybe a little bit of why?
Yeah, sure. I initially liked Kerr Dullah because he was just kind of, and David Bowman as the kind of commander of the ship. I liked his look, you know. I liked that style, that kind of, you know, he looked straight out of the Apollo mission. And that's fine. But then, to be honest, when I watched and read the characters in the book. I think Haywood Floyd, eventually Haywood Floyd, is my favorite character in the movie. I like cool. I like the way he's done. So I'll end with Haywood Floyd. That was
awesome. Yeah, cool. And what about you, Sandra?
I also really liked Poole. He was my favorite character. I just like how, again, how calm and cool and collected he was, especially when faced with, you know, having made mistakes, being caught out in that pod without his helmet. And
Bowman rather than Poole?
Yes, and I don't know why we're having so much difficulty with these.
I know. It's because they're just ciphers. They barely have character. There's no way to differentiate them, really, is there? Yeah, go ahead.
But we spend a lot of time looking at his face, watching him kind of almost chess match it out and get himself back into the ship and in a position where he could shut Hal down. And I just really liked his character the most. And he also, classic Apollo astronaut-looking gentleman.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. I went a little differently. I think my favorite character, and by favorite character, I don't necessarily mean character I agree with or that I like, as you know, as a beacon of virtue. My favorite character in the film is actually Hal, because, and again, I didn't want to get into it too much earlier. I think that is the character that I felt the most for. So when he kind of starts saying, you know, I'm afraid, I can feel it, I can feel my mind going. And then the tragedy of just like, would you like to hear this song? And the horrible kind of daisy fading as he dies. That was the part that affected me the most. And so I kind of had to say, as a character, Hal was perhaps my favorite because it was the one that impacted me the hardest. Again, don't think he's right, but still, yeah. So Ken, we're back to you. Do you have a favorite kind of moment or scene in the film you wanted to shout out?
Oh, Jesus, that's really difficult. I mean, there are just so many scenes. I think the conversation serves no further purpose is probably the best one because you can use so much of it in memes and stuff like that, you know. And I do, as a child in me, you know, I do tend out of absolute inner private joke, you know, when somebody's annoying me in a business situation, I do send them that sentence. I honestly think this conversation serves no further purpose. And I actually laugh to myself. It's kind of like a stress relief button, you know. I press the howl button. And that comes up on any kind of commentary or you know, Twitter assault, you know, or all that kind of, and then emails that from people I'm really not interested in doing business with. So yeah, I think that whole scene, Sandra touched on that as well about the visual aspect of it because he was looking, he was analysing, he was going, excuse my English, how do I get back into this ship? You know, and that you could see that. Whereas you're 100% right. If that was Bruce Willis, he'd be coming up with every kind of, he'd be talking to himself like some crazy dude. Yeah, come on, we got to get in here. Like, God damn it. You know?
Yeah.
But like, you know, it's the NASA astronaut. It's the don't panic sort of thing. It's kind of like keep calm, carry on sort of attitude. And I think it was the best scene. Yeah, it was the best scene.
Do you have a particular moment or scene you wanted to shout out as a favorite?
I sure did. My favorite, which I could watch over and over again, is you know, him circling around the ship, both working, but particularly when he's running in the beginning and the way the perspective shifts and changes and the long lens again, how that's filmed. And then again, the symmetry of the way that the shot is set up. I really, really, really love that scene.
Yeah.
That's a brilliant scene, actually. And the amount of work that went into that, you know, where he's standing and Poole is in the command module at the controls, flight controls. Yeah. And they're in a different, you know, they're in a different perspective. Like, it's just brilliant.
Yeah.
But again, for them, it's mundane. He's doing his morning jogging routine. They're checking off things on a clipboard, but that just looks so spectacular. And again, you can imagine yourself there running, you know, in that circular fashion. It's just amazing.
Absolutely. And I was saying, I didn't want to get too far into it because he'd be here forever because of the ins and outs of it. But you can look up how they did that. And they actually did like build a huge centrifuge that they were moving around. And, you know, they had the actors moving in. And it's just incredible because, again, the sheer detail and the way the effects were done, just mind blowing. So my favorite kind of scene, as it were, I just love the, as I've kind of alluded to a lot, the initial docking scene. So once we've moved away from the dawn of man and you have that gorgeous kind of waltz classical music and the wonder and the awe of the ship just taking its time docking in the station and how realistic it all looks. I love that. I could watch that, you know, over and over again. Cool. So do you have a particular favorite line that sticks out to you? Ken, welcome to you first.
Yeah, well, I just think I already gave that to you anyway. So it's
open the doors.
Dave. This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Hal gets all the best lines, although it's not actually one of my favorites, but yeah. I mean, the iconic ones are obviously, you know, open. I'm afraid I can't do that, Dave. Etc. So, sorry, hopefully I haven't stolen yours, Sandra, if I come and ask your favorite line.
Well, I figured someone would because those are so iconic. So I'll add to it that another great Hal moment or line is when he's being shut down and he sings
Daisy, give me your answer to.
That performance by Hal was probably one of the next best lines.
Yeah, just this, the way Daisy trails off as well as he's dying, as I said, it's just it's affecting, I think. So, yeah. So my favorite kind of bit of line, as it were, is...
Except for a single, very powerful radio emission aimed at Jupiter, the 4-million-year-old black monolith has remained completely inert. Its origin and purpose... still a total mystery.
That just sums up the film, doesn't it? Really?
Yeah, that's it. There's your blurb.
Yeah, exactly.
Just absolutely. Before we finish up, could I just actually give one shout out to the set designers who came up with the controls and the visuals for that?
Absolutely.
And I wanted to shout that out to all those people who don't get the shout out for that.
No, I'm glad you mentioned it because I should say that if you get a chance to look it up or you have the disc to hand, that's the actual menu screen for the 4K is the control panel with Hal in
them. It's beautiful. It's really beautiful. Of course, guys, if correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't that the same dimensions as the actual monolith?
The monolith, deliberately.
Yeah,
the rectangular
black square. I think that was just a little kind of an Easter egg, as they say, they threw in there, you know? So.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Cool. So we're just going to finish up then with our conclusions and our score out of 5 stars. We've been coming to you first the whole time, Ken, so we'll give Sandra a bit of time to gather her thoughts and I'll ask you for your conclusion and your score out of 5.
I would say it's one of the most influential science fiction movies of all time. I would say if you want to make good movies, if you feel you want to go into, you know, becoming a director in movies, it's a must watch because it's just like a guideline on what you can do and what you should do. As regards to an overall mark, I'm going to give it 4, right? Because, you know, it wasn't perfect, but actually I like that. You know, there was a few things that as an eternal watcher, I've seen it about maybe 10 or 15 times. There's a few things I still get annoyed over. So I'm going to just give it 4. But it's not because I don't like it. I just think it's because it wouldn't be in my top 10 of movies of all time, but that's only because I have a very eclectic mix of films. But definitely, I think it's a must watch and a must see for both the viewers and people in the film industry.
Cool. Slight surprise, but that's cool. And what about you then, Sandra? Have you got a conclusion and a score out of 5 for us?
I do. For me, the cinematography of this film is just for the time, very forward thinking, but I've mentioned it several times, how it stands the test of time and how it can still be rediscovered and appreciated today as something completely new and groundbreaking, and seeing how it birthed all of the sci-fi cinema that we see today, or at least so much of it, the cinematography, the beautiful effects, and the fact that it's not dated, all of that leads me to give it a 4.7 out of 5 stars.
You always pick a really random.
you're picking a warp speed there, Sandra.
Cool. Well, I'll finish this up with my conclusion and score then. So I said the movie, this movie, perhaps more than any other we might cover as a classic, is something of a subjective experience. boring, slow, and even pretentious drivel, or a work of sublime art? I fall firmly into the latter category. Like art, it invites the viewer not to necessarily be so passive. The more surreal moments are an opportunity to place your own meaning or multiple meanings, or heck, just acknowledge that not everything needs a meaning. Whether you prefer a straightforward narrative or not, and by the way, there's still one in here, you can admire the artistry, the visuals, the juxtaposition of music and imagery, or simply scenes and moments that have rightly become iconic. It might not be for everyone, but if it connects and touches you in some way, then it's really something special. A genius work of art that I unashamedly adore. And I actually gave it 5 out of 5 and did not think I would be the only one that did that. So, yeah, I love this. I think once it hits you, it just hits you. So adding those together and multiplying by 3 to give us our final score then. 2001 A Space Odyssey gets a final score of 4.6 out of 5, which is,
I think that's realistic.
Yeah,
I think that's a real, I think he would, you know, Stanley would have been proud of that one, because, you know, being such a perfectionist, I don't think he would have liked the kind of patronizing if everybody went, oh, it's so amazing, you know. So I think he'd be happy with that.
Yeah, 4.6 still a dang good score, and it's still close second out of the 3 that we've done so far. So awesome. Cool. Well, we're going to get out of here, but just before I do that, it only remains for me to thank both of you guys, Ken and Sandy, for coming and joining me on today's classic review.
Pleasure. Thank you. Thanks for inviting me. I think you know that this was always on the cards. If anybody else had done this, I would have used my particular set of skills.
Awesome. Cool. So, Ken, do you have anywhere on the internet you want to shout out where people can find you?
I think the best place to find me is, because social media has gone so crazy and it's just absolutely insane. I have my podcast, which is thecomfortablespot.com. I introduce, you know, my listeners to a lot of interesting people. Some you will know and some you don't, but I think you find most of them very interesting. And I do always respond to comments on that on my website. And I do also respond to emails, because I'm really giving up on social media. It's gone absolutely so. It's such a horrible place to be on. You can't criticize anything. You can't, you know, speak about yourself in any way, shape, or form without somebody hurling abuse at you. So I would like, if people want to find out about what my podcast is about, just go to the website, comfortablespot.com. It's the best place to find me.
Awesome. Great podcast as well. And I'll pop the link in the description.
Very much appreciated.
And yeah, thanks Sandy for coming back on for the first time in a while, in between all your hectic moving and various things in your life.
Thank you. Yes, I really excited that I got to be included on this one and got to talk about this with you guys. I really, really loved this film. And I'm also staying away from social media for my own mental health. So you can find me on Mike's Discord. And lastly, I just wanted to give a shout out to the long list of instructions in front of the zero gravity toilet. I hope you didn't wait to the last minute to go.
That's excellent.
That was a very Kubrick joke that was there deliberately. Oh. But yeah, you can actually freeze frame and they are all there.
There's we will end on that one. That's brilliant. Yeah, yeah. Cut the crap, Stanley. Okay. That's good.
Fantastic.
Like that. Well done, Stanley. Yeah, that's brilliant.
Hopefully, if you're watching on YouTube, there'll be something on screen that I've made that will show you all the places on social media that you can find me and the podcast. But you can always find it in the link tree and description of wherever you're listening or watching this. I won't go through the whole thing all over again, but yeah, we're basically everywhere, and most places we're just Silver Screen Podcast or my name, Michael Wilson. So yeah, I had a great time with this, and a film we all clearly adored. Keep on tuning into this channel, wherever it is that you are at the moment, because we're in the midst of a bit of everything. You'll get cinema classics once a month. You'll get cult classics with DK and guests once a month. And, you know, random Thursday editions of the original recipe, same great taste, Silver Screen Podcast. So I don't know exactly what's coming next, because our recordings are a bit all over the place, but there's a lot of treats, and do stay tuned to the channel for whatever that may be. And hopefully we'll have both of these guests back on to a future review, because I've had a great time. So yeah, awesome. Just remains for me to sign off then by saying, its origin and purpose still a total mystery.
You've been listening to the Silver Screen Podcast, hosted by Michael Wilson and DK. Produced and edited by Mike Wilson. Additional material and behind-the-scenes sections by DK. Follow us on social media. Links to all of our social media pages can be found via the Linktree page listed in the episode's description. This podcast is part of the Mike's Podcast Network. You can listen to this and our sister podcasts on all good podcast providers by searching for Silver Screen Podcast or Mike's Podcasts. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share far and wide. Thank you for joining us. Come back next time for more movie magic, and hopefully this can be the beginning of a beautiful friendship.